So, you're listening to Benji Wertheimer and Steve Gorin.
What?
You may not be able to hear it clearly. Hello. So, again, welcome. I just did another mute because I believe someone just came in. If by any chance you're on Skype or using a cell phone, it would be great if you would push the mute button so that there isn't interference with the call. And I again like to welcome you all with deep love and respect to our class on turning karma into destiny. It's been very beautiful. Hearing about the deep ways that these practices have been bringing stuff up, have been clearing stuff, have been raising questions that very often we don't contemplate, but which when we do begin to contemplate them, have a way of really shifting the way we're experiencing our lives in a moment-to-moment way. And I know that many of you are really seeing karmic patterns surfacing, doing a kind of recapitulation, which is part of the real gift that contemplating the question of karma gives us, and which is also one of the main ways that we shift our karmas. The practice of recapitulation, or as it's called in many traditions, confession, is actually one of the deepest and most powerful ways there is to change our karmas. So, as we begin, we're going to chant and offer an aspiration and do just a few moments of meditation. Then we're going to talk a little bit about power, because there have been a lot of questions about it, what power karma really is about. And then we'll start looking at the antidotes, the methods for freeing ourselves of karmas, and the practices that we're really going to take forward into the next week and hopefully into the rest of your lives. So please seat yourself in a comfortable and upright posture. And as you bring yourself present here this afternoon, this evening, for some of you it's still light outside as it is for me, for others it's quite far advanced into the evening. So we'll begin today this afternoon by practicing a version of the sweeping breath, which is one of the great ways that we can begin to free ourselves of the kind of situational entanglements that we take with us from our day and begin to just open ourselves to a clear space. So begin by breathing in and having the sense that the sitting bones and hips and thighs get grounded, and then exhaling with the feeling that the sitting bones form a very, very heavy and deeply rooted base out of which your upper body can rise up through the crown. Inhale and let the chest lift. Exhale and let the shoulder blades release down the back. Inhale and have the feeling that whatever tensions there are in the body are coming to the surface. And then exhale with the sense that you're letting tension and holding go. And this particular version of the sweeping breath that we're going to practice is about taking back the energies that we may have left in the situations and the people we've encountered during the day, and then giving back the energies that may have come to us through our interactions with others. So we'll do the inhalation exhalation with a sense of situations themselves. inhaling, let your head turn towards the left, and as you do, imagine yourself breathing back the energy that you may have left at work, that you may have left in conversations with your family members, that may have gone into a very attached set of feelings that you've had towards another person or a very averse set of feelings. So inhale, sweeping your head, turning your head all the way to the left with a sense that you're breathing back in the personal energies that you've left in your world today. And then with the exhalation, have the feeling that you breathe back any energies that you may have taken on from others. Again, inhaling, breathe back in the scattered energies. Your own energy that may have been scattered into others and you don't have to know where it went. Just breathe it back in. And then with the exhalation, feel that you're breathing back any energy that belongs to other people that may have come into your field. And continue this for just 5 breaths. Inhaling, turning your head to the left, breathing back energies of your own. Exhale, turning your head to the right, breathing out the energies that you may have taken on from others or the world. And with it, you can have the thought, as you inhale, may all the energies that I have sent out into the world and left with other people and in situations that I've encountered, may all these energies come back to me. And then exhaling, may all the energies that have come to me through others flow back to them. Now we'll chant the mantras invoking the grace of the infinite in the name Shiva, the underlying auspiciousness, the fundamental goodness at the heart of everything. And we'll chant as we have been with Krishna Das. And then we'll make an invocation offering our practice. Breathing in and breathing out. you can silently repeat to yourself, may what we are about to do yield beneficial results. May it give us the power to be of real benefit to others. May it help us overcome our delusions. May it clear away obstacles on the path. May what we are about to do increase our love and propel us towards enlightenment. The inhalation, have the feeling that you're breathing in the area in front of your body and breathing it out. So you're taking in the energy and the space in front of you. And then with the exhalation, you gently allow that energy and that spaciousness to flow back out into the world. Feel that with the inhalation you breathe in the area behind you. And with the exhalation you breathe it back out, back into the world. With the inhalation, breathe in the space, the area to the left of your body, and very gently allow it to be breathed back into the atmosphere. Of your body, breathing in that space and breathing it out. And now breathe in the area below you and breathe it out. Breathe in the area above you and breathe it out. Now have the sense, just for a moment, that you're breathing in the area all around your body, breathing it in through your pores, and that with the exhalation it flows out through your pores. And that through this breath, you recognize your connection to the space around you. And the connection of that space within which you're living, the connection of that to you. and you can open your eyes. So, as we've been looking at the karmic patterns behind your experience and your use of power, some of you have done this very deeply. Some of you have felt confusion about it, and I think one of the reasons for this, one of the reasons we sometimes feel confused about our karmas around power, is because many of us, especially as spiritual seekers, are either not comfortable with power or have a sense that as spiritual seekers we're not supposed to be involved with personal power. So I want to just speak a little bit to that subject, and first of all to acknowledge something that Susan said in a letter that she wrote to the listserv earlier today, which is that the ultimate power, the source of power, is the Shakti herself, is the force of nature herself, and that at moments when we really tune into the actual depths of the great power in this universe, it really shifts our experience of what power is. So whether we experience it in a wave, or as a couple of people said, when we are in the middle of childbirth, when that power that's bringing the child out of our bodies is doing its thing regardless of our own timing or our own feelings, when we're experiencing the power that brings in the breath, whether we are choosing to breathe or not, when we start to realize what power really is, then we might recognize that in our relationship to power, we're actually in relationship to the divine. And we're also in relationship to the personal ego. And that one of the ways in which we begin to tease out our karmic patterns in this regard is to start to see very clearly and to ask ourselves, how do we see power? How do we use power? You know, because it's a core aspect of both our intersubjective experience, that is to say, our experience with others, but also with our intrasubjective experience, the way we experience ourselves. You know, it's sometimes said that if you happen to be in a house where there's a baby, you realize that the baby is in a certain sense the most powerful person in the house because he or she is the most helpless. That, you know, because of the helplessness of the baby has the power to bring everybody's attention to fulfilling the baby's needs. Well, that may be true in one sense, but from the point of view of the baby, not that I really remember what it was like to be a baby, but my sense is, when I've tuned into it, that there's also a tremendous feeling of powerlessness because you're not always able to, for example, feed yourself when you're hungry. You have to rely on others, and I think that our first experiences of both power and powerlessness take place at that level. So at certain times, we may get the feeling of power from our beauty, or our strength, or our ability to manipulate other people, and let's face it, many human beings, including most of us, are very conscious, or perhaps unconscious, of our ability to manipulate other people. We may get our sense of power from our ability to think well, to articulate, or from our charisma, or from having money. You know, it's in our society, having money is hugely important to many people's sense of power. And so we may feel powerless when we sense a lack in those areas. And, for example, when we're looking at, you know, some of the gnarly aspects of our karmic relationships with power, we might notice that in a relationship, in a relationship, for example, between spouses or between parent and child, or between you and your boss, or you and your subordinates, the power may be with the person who can actually affect the status of the other person, for example, by firing them or giving them a bad evaluation report, as was discussed in the New York Times today, for those of you who read the New York Times. in a romantic relationship, often the power is with the person who cares the least, that is, who's most able to leave the relationship. Or it might be with the person who has the most money. This is often true in a marriage. It might be the person who's the most articulate in particular situations. And the power might move from one person to another. And of course, in a healthy relationship, it does. We constantly exchange power. We give each other power, and we accept each other's power. In work situations, the way the power operates may often be more obvious. But the point is that it's always at play in any situation, for better or for worse. And there are times when we use our power for obvious good, when we can exercise power to help someone else or to influence them in a way that's beneficial, we hope. And there are times when we don't. And again, what I've found is that in looking at my karmas around power, it's been especially interesting to look at two things. First, the times when I have not used my power wisely, and the times when I have denied my own power. And sometimes the two are very allied, because very often people who aren't aware of their own power create damage that they would not create if they were more conscious of the ways in which they have power in the situation. One of the most powerful, excuse me for using this word, one of the most helpful definitions that I've ever heard about power and karma comes from Scott Peck, who wrote a book called People of the Lie, in which he talked about the issue of evil in the world. And his point was that ordinary people, people who never think of ourselves as evil, and it's a tough word, you know, it's a Scott Peck was a Christian, and he was speaking very much in Christian terminology. But very often, quite ordinary people will use their power in ways that is actually quite harmful. He used the word evil, I would say, creating bad karma occurs when you use your power to avoid spiritual growth. When you use your power to avoid spiritual growth. For example, when you're in a situation with somebody else, where they're obviously suffering from something about your interaction, and you absolutely refuse to cop to your part in the contribution system, what you're doing there is avoiding spiritual growth. And this is one of the ways in which we create bad karmas for ourselves, or let's say difficult negative karmas for ourselves, through the way we use with power. A Japanese Zen master, whom I read many years ago, was once asked whether he was ever tempted to misuse his power as the head of a monastery. And he said that as the abbot, his position was so public that everything he did was very obvious to people. In other words, when he didn't use his power well, everybody knew about it. But he said that the really difficult situation in his life, the one that where he was constantly tempted to misuse his power, was when he was the head of the kitchen in the monastery. And there was a young monk who worked in the kitchen, who was the kitchen monk. The two of them worked side by side. Nobody else ever saw them. And he said that he was constantly tempted to give this young monk the dirtiest jobs, or to scold him when things didn't go well. And that was when he saw the ways in which he had a tendency to abuse power. So very often, if we really want to look at ourselves, we'll see that when we misuse power or give our power away, it's very often in these very private, secret ways. So ask yourself how you might have used your power, your charm, your intelligence, your ability to win an argument, to avoid spiritual growth, by which I mean the obligation to transcend your limitations. And think of the small ways in which you might habitually do this. How have you used your power for spiritual growth or to avoid spiritual growth? So this is a question that you can ask yourself now and notice what comes up. And I'm also going to ask you to look at it part of your contemplation during the week. So right at this moment, you can breathe in with the feeling, the sense, that you're breathing in power. Just let yourself breathe in power, the feeling of power, whether it's an uncomfortable feeling or an intoxicating feeling. Just notice what it feels like to breathe in power. Breathe it in through your heart and allow it to be held by the great heart energy behind you, the great heart energy that stretches out behind you. And then with the exhalation, breathe the energy of the great heart back through your own heart and into the world. And just continue breathing in your sense of power. In this sense, we mean egotistical power. The power that we secretly want or we secretly deny. Breathe it in through the heart, offer it into the great heart energy. And then breathe out the love and the wisdom, the softness, the tenderness, the deep transformative power of the great heart energy. Breathe it through your body with the sense that as you breathe it out, you're breathing it out into all the ideas you may have about power. All the egoic needs and desires and ways of disowning power that you may have. In a sense, you're breathing in power as an egoic force, breathing it into the great heart and then breathing out the loving, tender, soft, healing energy of the great heart into your body, into the world. So one of the ways in which we work with power and with a sense of powerlessness, which is an equally karmic and ego-controlled situation, is through the Tonglen practice of sending and receiving. So in our discussions of karma and in our practice with karma, what we're also working with is the understanding about choice. You know, in the East, where they understand the laws of karma in a very precise way, there's actually a lot of science in the Eastern tradition's understanding of karma, but they also tend to look at the karmic journey rather deterministically. You know, for example, you commit certain actions, they have a certain result. It's very eye for an eye. You do your best to live with the consequences. That's the way you deal with it. And you do your best to accumulate merit so that your future will be as positive as possible. I mean, that's the basic understanding about karma in the East, and it's very useful up to a point, and we'll be discussing it later on. In the West, we have a less deterministic way of looking at karma. For example, Western teachings on karma tend to stress the choice factor rather than the determinism of our past destiny coming to fruition in this lifetime. The Western teachings on karma are really much more focused on our choices. And in other words, rather than encouraging us to look at our life situations as the results of our past merits or demerits, the Western vision sees the soul as experiencing choice points, including choice points that take place between lives. someone wrote into the listserv last week about an experience she had in which she saw herself in a subtle, otherworldly state, discussing with a group of others her plans for her next life, which I think was actually the life she's in now. And I found it very interesting because there's a famous series of books by a hypnotherapist named Michael Newton, which reports experiences of his clients who regressed into between life states and saw themselves with a group of souls discussing the lessons and experiences that they thought would be appropriate for their next life, as well as discussing what they had learned or accomplished or not accomplished in their life just passed. It's actually, I kind of love this view of it because it's a wonderful thought to imagine that in between lives you get to sit with a study group and sort of look at what you've done and what you haven't done. Of course, like everything that happens between lives, we have really no way of knowing what's true and what's people's subjective experience. But this particular type of experience is one that that runs through many of the Western teachings on life between lives, on reincarnation, on the way we work with our destiny. One of the points that kept coming up is that when you enter into a life, you choose circumstances that will allow you to work out certain things. But what you can't control is the effect that these life circumstances might have on other aspects of your destiny. So, for example, let's say that we come into this world with a particular intention. Say, for example, that you have a sense that you've missed out on educational opportunities in the past, or that there's a particular kind of work or service that you very much want to accomplish in this life, and it requires a certain kind of upbringing and education in order to have the capacity to do it in an efficient way. So you find yourself born in a family where there are a lot of educational opportunities, but maybe there's not too much ability to give affection. So in that sense, your intention to be well educated is accomplished in a way that you might not have intended, in which you may not be able to experience genuine affection in your early life, and that creates an impression that you then have to work out later on. This is the way that the karmic dance goes on. And of course, one of the things that happens is that when you come into this life, you forget you made the choice, and you don't necessarily understand why you find yourself in the circumstances you find yourself in. One of the teachings that I've come across in many of the Western traditions on karma and reincarnation is the idea that the older and more mature a soul is, that is to say, by mature, I mean, or they seem to mean, the more the soul has learned the importance of spiritual growth, the more the soul will tend to choose situations that are less about worldly success in the way that a younger soul might go after worldly success, and more about situations in which they can perhaps live peacefully, do spiritual practices, or work out deep lessons that have been on the books, so to speak, for a few lifetimes. And many, many of these lessons are about power. So those of us who've lived a lot of lives are often people who've in some lives misused power or caused suffering to people, because that's just the way life is. And many of us, many of the spiritual people I know have actually chosen to live lifetimes, perhaps many lifetimes, of service and self-sacrifice and austerity, with the understanding that what they're doing is eliminating or burning through the samskaras that might have caused them to misuse power in that, in their earlier, more, shall I say, power-hungry lifetimes. And very often, when a spiritually practiced soul comes into a lifetime like this one, they come in with particular lessons about power that they're getting to work out in this lifetime, and they they may be, they often are, understandings that cause us to give up our power, to surrender our power, because we are worried about misusing it. Or they might be the opposite. People may come into this life with a very, very strong desire to prove that they can use power appropriately, and actually go through some of the lessons about power that they've, they may have failed the course in some sense in a former life. So power in the lives of spiritual practitioners and in spiritual organizations and spiritual groups is very often a big issue that's not often talked about, because in some way spiritual people feel like we ought to not be power mongers in the sense that worldly people are, but in which, in fact, many of these lessons about power are being worked out. In Plato's Republic, as some of you may remember, there's a story called The Myth of Er. The name is spelled E-R, about a soldier who has a near-death experience, and he finds himself in the space between lives, in what the Tibetans call the bardo, between lives. And there he sees many souls waiting to choose their next life. They're on the banks of a river, of the river Lhasa, which is an important river, an important marker of the borderline between this world and the other world in Greek mythology. And there on the bank of the river is a pile of lives. Souls are going to get to choose their next life, and according to the kind of lives they've lived, they get to have first pick or last pick. And the first choices go to people who've led good lives, dharmic lives, unselfish lives. But what he sees is that many of the souls who've been tyrants or who have oppressed others in some way actually pick very obscure lives, and not always because they don't have a lot of choices. They often do it because they want to avoid running into the same kinds of difficult choices that may have faced them in lives as leaders. And that some people who have lived very righteous lives decide to go for the adventure of a life where they have ample opportunities to use power. And once the souls have made these choices, they jump into the river, which is the river of forgetfulness, so that when they come into their next life, they forget they've chosen it and they forget why. Now, this is obviously a myth, but myths and stories have a way of presenting truths that we all play out in our lives. And if you consider the life that you're living was chosen, that is, it wasn't random chance or the deterministic playing out of your backpack of actions that put you in the life you live now, then sometimes you really can see the particular lessons that you chose to learn here, the particular gifts that you came in with, and the areas in which you're being asked to grow, what you're being asked to learn. And you might see why you've made certain choices that seem counterintuitive, or that even put you at a disadvantage, not because you've done something bad in your last life and we're having to work it out in this one, but really for the sake of growth in a particular area. You know, in my life, for example, I chose for many years to put my writing skills into an anonymous service to my teacher rather than writing for publication under my own name. And people used to say to me that I was sacrificing my creative abilities. But from another point of view and from my own perspective, I was actually experiencing enormous grace and transformation as a result of that service. So, you know, it was a choice that was not really that selfless a choice. It was a choice to receive something that was important to me in this life. In another lifetime, and this is, I think, has been true for quite a few of you, in a given lifetime, you may be working with the issue of loyalty, which is a deep, deep karmic learning for almost every human being that we often have to deal with in many, many lifetimes, the issues of loyalty and betrayal. And, for example, you may find yourself in a situation in which you're required to demonstrate loyalty to a flawed leader, to fight in a war that you don't really approve of, or to grow up in a family where family members are addictive or abusive. So the right choice, the choice of integrity, the karmically appropriate choice for you in this situation may be to live in it with complete loyalty and take the consequences for better or worse. Or it may be that your lesson is to recognize that your loyalty is misplaced and to refuse to serve. So often, you know, these situations are played out for soldiers, of course for people in organizations, certainly for many of us in our family situations. And the choices are often extraordinarily difficult. And there are times when the choices we make cause regret. And there are also times when our apparently regrettable choices are the result of an honest attempt to change a pattern that, you know, that we recognize as unproductive, but didn't really know how to change. There's a wonderful story that Simone Weil, the French existentialist philosopher, told about herself. In the 1930s, she joined a pacifist organization that turned out to be fascist, and for which her reputation suffered tremendously. So she spent many hours asking herself why she'd done it. It was a cause of enormous regret for her, and she realized, as she thought about it deeply, that the real reason that she had moved to join this organization without really thinking it through was because she was trying to cure her own laziness about taking action, her own hesitance about taking action. And basically, she said, she was so embarrassed about the fact that she often didn't bother to clean her own house, that is, sweep her floor, for weeks on end, that she jumped into activism really as a way of proving that she was actually not a lazy person at all. So how many of us have done things like that, made precipitous actions because we were trying to cure a tendency in ourselves, and then realized that perhaps we hadn't done it as skillfully as we might have wanted to? So just for a moment, bring to mind something that you've done that you regret. Something that you did with good intention that didn't turn out well. A mistake that you made. Can be a big one or a small one, whatever comes to mind just at this moment. And breathe that situation and the feelings of regret in through your heart, into the great love, the great heart energy behind you. And then breathe the loving, tender, profound compassion and love of the great heart energy back through your heart into that situation where you acted in ways that were less skillful than you would have liked. And think of someone whom you know or whom you've heard of, again, the first person who comes to mind, who has done something that you think was a tremendous mistake. And breathe that person's energy, the energy of their mistaken actions and perhaps of the regret that they may feel, or even of the pain that it may have caused. Breathe it in through your heart and offer it into the great heart energy. And then with the exhalation, breathe the compassion and love of the great heart back through your own heart and into that person and into that situation. And again, breathing in your sense of the energy of someone who has done something that you feel was a mistake, a well-intentioned action that may have caused suffering to them or to others. Breathe that energy back in through your heart and offer it into the great heart. And then breathe the energy of the great heart back through your own heart and into that person. And one more time. In the Tao Te Ching, there's a description of what it means to act skillfully in the midst of our karmas. And of course, like all the teachings of the Tao Te Ching, it describes the behavior of an enlightened being. But as you listen to it, see if you can feel the perfume of what it is to walk through karma in such a way that you're untouched by it. Those skillful in the ancient Tao are subtly ingenious and profoundly intuitive. So careful as if wading in a stream in winter. So hesitant as if respecting all sides in the community. So reserved as if acting as a guest. So yielding as if ice about to melt. So candid as if acting with simplicity. So open as if acting as a valley. So integrated as if acting as muddy water. Who can harmonize with muddy water and gradually arrive at clarity? Who can harmonize with muddy water and gradually arrive at clarity? Who can harmonize with muddy water and gradually arrive at clarity? The deep secret of action in the midst of our karmic circumstances. It's very important to recognize that karmic patterns blind us sometimes. Sometimes when we're trying to carve out a new way of living, a new way of being, the winds of our karmic patterns are so strong that it literally feels as if we were trying to walk into a headwind. You know, a friend of mine compares it to walking across a bridge with a dust storm blowing in your eyes. So you can't see. And if the storm is strong enough, you may just feel like giving up. But in that case, and I would say this is true in the practices that we do for working with our deep patterns, it's really enough to make incremental changes and decisions. For example, for someone who has a pattern of being afraid of intimacy, which may have roots in this life but may go back many lifetimes, clearly one of the tasks of this lifetime may be, not always, but may be to deepen the capacity for intimacy. And this may happen through making false steps that lead you into intimacies that are not so good for you, or that lead you to trust people or to try to trust people that are not really trustworthy. But there will also be moments when you actually open up to intimacy and your capacity for trust is confirmed, and you realize that you're a little bit better at it than you were when you started. Or your pattern may have been to live as dependent on others, or to have little control over your personal choices, as was the case for women in traditional societies, or for people who in other lives were very poor or had little access to opportunities. And in this lifetime, you may be in the process of learning how to exercise confidently self-determination, and you may need to work with karmic patterns of low self-esteem and feelings of helplessness. But again, every small act, every small mind-changing practice that stems from self-confidence is a major victory in this practice. Just as if you're someone who's misused power, every moment of using your power to help somebody, every moment of not being selfish, is a major step in the transformation of your patterns. You know, and one of the beautiful things that neuroscience has shown us is that because our neurons, because our brains are plastic, because we actually can change the way the synapses work in our brain through changing our thoughts and actions, our characters change. You know, our karmic imprints change through our practice. So even though we may be walking into the windstorm, in the sense that certain events in our lives feel difficult or unfair, and, you know, we're tempted to feel angry or resentful or take shortcuts or whatever, these are the moments to recognize that we are probably right in the midst of the karmic situation that we came in this life to untie. And here's the thing. We don't always know the quote, right, unquote, way to act. I mean, of course, in the traditions, there are, so to speak, the rules, and the rules pretty much agree with each other. You know, for example, there are the five precepts of Buddhism, which ask you to pursue right livelihood, to stay away from violence and telling lies and intoxication and sexual practices that harm others. These are very also similar to the yamas and niyamas, the do's and don'ts of yoga, which are things like nonviolence, non-stealing, truthfulness. In Christianity and Judaism, of course, there are the Ten Commandments, and there's also, as there are in almost every other tradition, there's the great rule, which, you know, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And in the deep traditions of India, there are texts that deal with the situational complexities of right action, of action that changes your destiny. And in these texts, they talk about the way, they're very modern in the sense that they talk about how social context matters in behavior, in which your culture matters, in which we're sometimes asked to behave unconventionally for the sake of a higher aim. In other words, there are certain situations in which breaking the rules is the correct karmic action. And of course, this takes enormous discernment, and that's why karma is so mysterious. You know, for example, the correct action of a person in corporate leadership, the dharma of such a person, isn't the same as the dharma of an artist. Your dharma with a friend is different than your dharma with your child, and the dharma of a mother or a father may be different when he or she is dealing with her kids than it is when he or she is at work. So the practice of living consciously is not necessarily subject to rules, and so we actually do need, aside from our own capacity for discernment, we need guidelines as to know what is correct in a naughty situation. In other words, how do we turn our karma into destiny, into the kind of action that will give us the experience of having fulfilled our purposes in this life? And I want to offer you, in the time that remains, two blueprints, one of which is a general blueprint for correct action, and the other of which is a blueprint for changing your karmas, for working with difficult karmas specifically. So the first comes from the Vedic tradition of India. It's actually from a text called the Yajnavalkya Samhita. Yajnavalkya being a sage who appears in many of the dialogues in the Upanishads and was a great source of wisdom on many, many subjects that are very relevant to us today. And what he says is the sources of dharma, that is, correct action, are known to be these: the sacred texts, the practices of the good, whatever is agreeable to one's own self, and the desire that has arisen out of wholesome resolve. So therefore, first of all, when you're trying to figure out what to do, you think about what the teachings of your tradition or of the teachings that have resonated with you, and all of us have them, what does the teachings tell you? And the second is, what would a good person do? The third is, where's your bliss? What gives you joy? And what works for you? What practice are you suitable for? In other words, there's no point in jumping into the river to save a drowning child if you don't know how to swim. And this is, of course, true of many other situations. And the fourth is a desire that's arisen out of a wholesome resolve. And then the passage goes on to say, over and above such acts as self-control, nonviolence, giving generously, studying the truth, the highest dharma, the highest form of good action, is the realization of the self by means of yoga. very often people would come to my guru and ask them, what's my dharma? What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to go back to college? Am I supposed to marry this person? You know, is it okay for me to go to work in corporate America if I'm a yogi? And he would say, do what you think best, but your dharma, your real dharma, is to know your own deep self. So the question you should ask yourself whenever you make a decision is this going to lead me more deeply into the connection with the self, with the great self? The answers can be surprising. But I just want to take a moment to go through these four guidelines, because for me they've been tremendously helpful in determining choice. You know, the sacred teachings. The reason that a spiritual education is important is not so that we can accumulate a lot of knowledge to give our yoga students, if we happen to be yoga teachers, you know, or to amuse ourselves or entertain ourselves, but it's so that we can learn to recognize those teachings that stick out for us, that show up for us. You know, there's certain teachings that are your teaching, that, you know, you read the Bhagavad Gita and something comes out, you know, something just jumps out at you. You read the Tao Te Ching and one particular sentence jumps out at you, and it's really, for many of us, there are one or two teachings that will come up again and again and again in moments of choice. For me, the teaching, and it's been this way for years, is you have a right to the work alone, but never to its fruits. That particular teaching, which is from the Bhagavad Gita and which is profound and mysterious, has actually showed up for me during times when I would otherwise have just had no understanding of why things worked out the way they do. The second guideline for working with your own karma to turn it into dharma, into destiny, is to ask yourself the question, it's often asked is, what would Jesus do? Or what would the Dalai Lama do? Or what would Martin Luther King do? My friend Lee, who's a spiritual teacher in northern New Mexico, has a way of formulating this question which I really love. What he says is, what would a really mature person do into this situation? Or, to put it another way, what would a real grown-up do in this situation? It's a very beautiful way of tuning into your wise self. What would a really mature person do in this circumstance? The mature person in you knows. And it's less high-flown than asking yourself what the Dalai Lama would do, because we're not always capable of doing what the Dalai Lama would do, but we are capable of doing what our mature self would do. So the third guideline is, whatever makes you happy, whatever is agreeable to your own self. That's the Joseph Campbell point, follow your bliss. In any choice that you make, in general, it's very important to ask yourself, what would give me joy? Which of these alternatives would give me joy? Maybe joy in the short run, but certainly joy in the long run. And the fourth of the guidelines has to do with aspiration, with the desire that arises out of a wholesome resolve, a wholesome aspiration. So this practice, this practice of aspiration, which nowadays we call sometimes the power of intention, is probably the foremost practice, the foremost way we have of shifting our karmas, especially in situations where we don't feel that we're playing with a full deck, or where we're working with something that feels quite difficult to shift. So the essential beneficial aspiration is the wish that any action you take be of benefit to others. The aspiration that we did at the beginning of the class today and last week is a very beautiful one. Beneficial aspiration is sometimes called the propelling power. The propelling power, because it propels us almost immediately into a better state. And, you know, you'll notice that as soon as you ask, may this action be for the benefit of others, may what I'm about to do bring happiness to all beings or to all the beings in my world, you notice that it immediately creates a more positive state. You know, if you're scared, if you're nervous, if you're in a negative mood, it really works. I'll give you a very mundane example. When I was learning to be a public speaker, I would often suffer from intense performance anxiety. And what I discovered was that if instead of thinking about how can I do this well so that people will like me, instead I would ask the question, how can what I say be of service to the people that I'm speaking to? It would not just reorient my content, it's pretty good for doing that, but it would completely change my attitude from anxiety to calm and even happiness. And, you know, when people ask me, when I'm working with someone who has to give a talk, this is the first thing I always tell them, that the most important thing is to have an aspiration to be helpful in that circumstance. It doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean being a wimp or being an enabler. It means really, really just making the aspiration that your actions be of benefit to the people in your world, to the person in front of you. So another way that we work with aspiration in the path of changing our karmas, and this is really Life Transformation 101, but the reason I want to tell you about it is because what I think we all find is that it's something we forget to do, and then when we remember to do it, it makes such a huge difference. So the way you work with aspiration in a really functional way is to pay attention to your first thought in the morning when you wake up and your last thought before you go to sleep. And I'm going to ask you, those of you who are on this call and those of you who will be listening later to the download, do this tonight and tomorrow morning. Our life is bracketed by these two moments, the moment before we go to sleep and the moment we wake up. So when you wake up in the morning, make a point of generating a positive intention. Think about the goals you want to accomplish today and see if you can recall your big goals, your great goals. So you might say, you know, my intention today is to get through this meeting in a way that's, you know, that really moves the project along, or to make sure that my son sends in his application to college. It might be, I resolve that today I'm going to experience loving relationship. Today I'm going to be authentic in everything I do. Today I'll move towards enlightenment. So you always want to have a positive, a beneficial aspiration that's situational, but also that takes you towards your greater goals. And then at the end of the day, you just take 5 minutes before you go to sleep. You can lie down with your eyes closed and ask yourself, how have you fulfilled your commitments? Honor yourself for your successes, and if you've been acting out some habitual pattern, rather than feeling bad about yourself, which is what we often do, you know, we often blow it in some way, and then that feeling of having blown it goes into our subconscious, and we just have a bad feeling. So it's really important to review your day, and when you notice that there's a bad feeling or a feeling that you didn't do as well as you like, to breathe it into the great heart, and then to breathe out compassion to yourself and to anyone else that may have been affected, and then make an intention and aspiration that tomorrow you'll pay very close attention to the state of your mind and create auspicious states of mind before you act. And if you do this as you drift into sleep, it'll give you better sleep, and it'll give you a really good chance of waking up with a feeling of freshness and enthusiasm. So, again, at this moment, inhale with the feeling that you're breathing in the space in front of you. And exhale, breathing it back. The space behind you. Inhale, breathe in the space behind you. breathe it back with the exhalation. Breathe in with the sense that you're breathing in the area to your right and to your left. Breathing it in through your pores and breathing it out. Breathing in with the feeling that you're breathing in the space above you and the space below you. And then breathing them back out. The feeling that you breathe in the area on all sides of your body, breathing them in through your pores, and breathing it back out. So the first power that we bring into play as we wish to and act to shift our karmic situation is the power of aspiration. The second one is the power of habit, of creating new habits. And this is where I'd like to give you the blueprint for changing karmas that both the Hindu and Buddhist traditions offer us. Two of the practices in it are kind of obvious, and two of them are not so obvious to the Western mind. And because the last two are less obvious, we're going to practice them at the end of the class. So there are actually four means, four applications for transforming difficult conditions that will change our karmas over time and will dissolve accumulated negativities. The first one is called in both Buddhism and Hinduism accumulating merit. In other words, doing good actions. And this idea of merit, it's a very religious concept in the minds of most of us. So often if we're not involved in a traditional form of practice, we may think that it's kind of a cut and dried mechanical issue, the idea of accumulating merit. I mean, the idea that you would practice good actions for the sake of accumulating merit. Why would you do that? It's a little bit like thinking of your good actions as your bank balance. In other words, I get so much merit from being nice to my mother when I was feeling impatient, and I have so much demerit for being rude to the person at the bank. But actually, merit isn't like that. Accumulating merit is actually about giving you the power to transform the energy around you. So the law, the rule, one of the rules of karma, is that when you have a lot of merit, you can actually avert obstacles before they even come your way, and you can overcome adversity when it shows up for you. When we have enough merit, a middling amount of merit, it gives us the power to overcome adversity. And when we have very little merit, we attract adversity. And again, we have different circumstances in our lives. Some of us have difficult circumstances, but the point is that by accumulating merit, we actually accumulate the power to dissolve these circumstances. So this is just the basic karmic principle. So what the teachers of the traditions often say is that if you're going to be greedy about acquiring merit, about anything, be greedy about acquiring merit. Essentially, you do this by cultivating positive mind states and by kindness and by practices like gratitude and forgiveness. You know, they are the basic nice guy practices that any spiritual person will tell you are good things to do. One of the main ways that we lose merit is by looking at our lives and looking at other people from a negative point of view. This doesn't mean that every time you have a negative thought, you should be scared. But it does mean that it really is very important to look at your own mental habits, to recognize when you're holding on to negativities, and to actually change them. You know, in other words, when you're filled with resentment about somebody else, actually look at it and make an effort to find a way to think well of them, or change your thought forms, or work with a mantra, or work with something like, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may this person be happy, may this person be healthy. In other words, get into the habit of substituting positive thoughts for negative thoughts. It's one of the fundamental ways of accumulating merit. I feel very strongly about creating positive mind states, partly because I actually had to work very hard in this life to overcome habits of projecting negativity, which came down which I acquired very honestly through my family line. My mother, who was an incredibly good person, who was a genuine servant to humanity, I can't speak highly enough about the way she lived her life, about the way she helped people. You know, about the way she was loyal to her friends and her family, about the way she would literally go out of her way for other people, both financially and in her actions. But she also had an incredibly negative, critical attitude about everyone and everything, and she was always looking at people's faults. And the result was, what I saw was that nobody could really give her the love and appreciation that she deserved for all the good things she did for them, because she always made it kind of unpleasant through her negativity. And one of the beautiful things I saw in my mother's life was that in her 60s, she started to recognize this, and she started to make a deliberate attempt to change, to literally change the way she thought and spoke about people. And her life circumstances began to change in this way. In the same way, when you habitually think well of yourself and others, when you offer blessings, it generates an enormous amount of energy that will change your life for the better and actually make your life happy in ways that you may not even think about, because it'll come to be the climate around you. It's true of many of you that you have that kind of positive climate around you. And I think all of us can think of people like that, people who have actually such a habit of kindness that everyone around them kind of falls into it. The other most positive form of a powerful form of positive action, other than working with your own mind, is service. That is, and there are two kinds of service. One is service to holy beings, which is possible for some of us and not possible for everybody. We don't live in a society in which they're necessarily necessarily a whole lot of holy beings around that we can offer food to, as existed in the traditions. But the other is service to the people around us, service to people who are in need, generous offerings, things as simple as driving a friend to the hospital. Again, these are the simple practices of what it takes to be a mensch, what it takes to be a good person. But one of the ways that when we're actually living consciously, one of the things that's actually very beautiful and helpful when we offer service is that we do it with the aspiration that our service be of benefit. Because sometimes we do very kind things for people, and we do them with an attitude of impatience or grudgingly, or because we think we should. So when we're offering service in all the ways that we do, and I know that all of us do, it's very important and very helpful to create a beneficial thought as we're doing it, so that we actually will think to ourselves, you know, when you answer the phone and someone asks you to do them a favor and you of course agree to do the favor, that you have the thought that you're being offered an opportunity to be of service, and that this is actually a great blessing. Because the truth is, we have to have quite good karma, quite a lot of merit, to be given the opportunity to serve. It's something to think about, you know, that we have to have quite a lot of merit for people to want us, for people to be willing to ask us for favors, for people to be able to expect something of us in the way of kindness. It really is a great gift to be able to offer service. So this is the quality of acquiring merit, which we do through kindness, through kind thoughts, and through service, especially through conscious service, through service rendered with the desire to be of service. So the second method for transforming karmas, and I'm going to send you these in your homework, so you don't have to worry about writing them down. The second method is confession. It is really a reason why confession is such a powerful practice in the traditions. And it's a practice in all the traditions, some form of confession, or we could say recapitulation. If there's something that you feel was wrong, telling someone else about it with genuine regret, or simply saying out loud to the universe, such and such an action was not a good thing to have done or to have said, and I regret it, and I ask forgiveness. That action of confession and asking forgiveness for specifics and also in general is an incredibly powerful practice for transforming your karmas. There's a teaching that's been going the rounds of many of my friends. It's a Hawaiian teaching, and I can't pronounce it. I have a really hard time pronouncing Hawaiian. But essentially, it is a practice of recognizing and asking for forgiveness, and it's more complexity to it than I'm going to relate to you. But basically, the idea behind it is that if anything happens in your world which is disruptive, if anyone comes into your world that's in pain or in difficulty, that what we do is we recognize that this situation wouldn't be in our world if we were not in some way responsible for it. This is a practice which actually recognizes our connection, our oneness. And what you then do is you, as soon as you notice that something is difficult or wrong, both in your own life or in the lives of people around you, you say, in whatever way I may have offended the forces of the universe, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. Thank you. It's very, very simple practice. In whatever way I or the people in my life may have offended the forces of the universe. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. Thank you. And this practice of recognizing and asking forgiveness is a, in some utterly mysterious but very powerful way, will actually has the power to shift situations around you. I'm going to ask you guys this week to do a practice of confession. It's related to the practice of looking at your karmic patterns, but to take an incident or a couple of incidents in your recent life in which you think you blew it. And I don't mean it doesn't have to be something really big, but something in which you feel that your actions did not reflect your highest aspirations. And confess it. And the way you do this is to say what happened in a very objective way, as though you were watching yourself, recording it with a camera eye. Say what happened, express your regret, and then just offer it up. And what you'll find is that this practice of confession and expression of regret and offering up will actually shift something in your field. It's one of the most powerful practices there is for changing your karmas. And of course, there are circumstances in which it's important to apologize, to write a letter, if necessary, to make restitution if necessary. So the practice of making amends, confession and making amends, it's one of the great time-honored ways of changing karmas. Now, the third and fourth methods are more mystical. They're more interior. And these are the practices of making offerings. Now, there are many different ways of making offerings. One of them, which you know, we actually worked with in the first week, one of the great offering practices is simply to offer anything that you're about to do with the sense that asking that it be a benefit to all beings. But there's another way of making offerings, in which you contact what we might call the elemental forces of the universe, the spirits, the energies, the protective forces, and the mischievous forces that exist in the subtle world all around us. And we don't have to be specifically aware of these forces, but it's very, very helpful just to have the sense that this world, this universe, is filled with unseen energies. Energies that live inside our bodies, that live in the places where we move and walk and work. And have the intention to remember and recognize all of these forces, these energies, these spirits, if you will. You know, spirits are simply energies, and they may be the energies that belong to a place, that belong to the animals in the place where you live, that belong to the fields of vibratory energy that have been left in a place by the people who've lived there. So what you then do is you bring to mind the energies surrounding you. Just have the thought, may all the protective, benign energies that are here in this field, may all the energies in this field which may be disturbed or unhappy, I bring them all to mind. And then you begin by making an offering to the spirits, that the energies that might be disturbed or unhappy or mischievous. You know, for example, there are times when you actually feel a kind of poltergeist energy in the atmosphere, or when, you know, you just have a sense of negative energies in a place or around you. And there's nothing to be afraid of, but it's very helpful just to acknowledge that these energies are present. And then here's what you do. You imagine in your mind's eye beautiful flowers and jewels. And I'm going to ask you to do this now. You don't have to visualize them exactly if you're not a good visualizer. Just have the sense that in front of you is a basket of beautiful flowers and a basket of jewels, of sapphires and rubies and diamonds, of gold coins. And you imagine yourself taking a handful of flowers and you offer it to all the energies that might be negative or mischievous, to all the energies that might be unhappy in the atmosphere. And just ask, may you be honored by this offering. And feel those flowers just dissolving into the atmosphere. And understand that they're being accepted and that these energies do feel honored. And then offer the jewels. Imagine yourself holding out a handful of jewels. Feel the light and the preciousness of them. And understand these are jewels made of light. And offer these jewels, asking that any energies in the atmosphere that are unhappy or upset or grieving or angry, just say, I honor you and I offer you these jewels of light, asking that you become happy. And then inwardly bow to these energies. And now bring to your mind a sense of the protective energies around you. You might have a sense of the presence of a teacher, or a saint, or simply a sense of those guardian energies that are part of everyone's life, the great mother heart who stretches out behind you. And all those powers, all those energies that bring good into the world. And once again, create a basket of flowers and a basket of jewels. And with a deep sense of gratitude, offer these flowers to the protective spirits, the loving energies that surround you, and that whether you are aware of them or not, are guarding and guiding your life. Take the handful of light jewels, these sparkling sapphires and diamonds and emeralds, the rubies, the gold made of light. And with a deep bow, offer them to the loving energies, the spirits, the protective guardian spirits who exist in the atmosphere around us. And you can take a moment and just think of things that you might offer, feelings of gratitude. Beautiful painting. Or imagine the most beautiful place that you've ever seen and offer that. The loving energies, the guardian spirits, the thought of some place truly beautiful. And then have the feeling of bowing and just ask I be protected. I recognize your intention for protection. I ask for your protection. I ask for guidance. And however it comes, I offer gratitude. I ask for protection. I recognize protection. I ask for guidance in all things, and however it comes, I recognize that guidance is present. And there's no need to believe anything. There's no need to wait for results. It's actually enough just to take a moment. Whenever you think of it, and make offerings like this. When you experience a negative energy, just call to mind, offer it flowers. And at all times, whether you're aware of it or not, call to mind the fact that you're surrounded by loving and protective energies. And offer them whatever comes to mind, whatever is beautiful. And ask for protection and guidance. And what will happen as you do this is that you'll begin to experience the beneficial results of tuning into the subtle energies around you. And these two practices are actually two of the most powerful ways there is to enlist protection and guidance and to create positive energy around yourself. It's really the practice of honoring the subtle world, of recognizing that there is more to this world than what we can see, and honoring it. So, the final week of our three-week class, in this week, we'll continue with our meditation practices, our practices of Namah Shivaya, our practice of Tonglen, of sending and receiving. And I'm also going to ask you to spend a few minutes this week doing a confession practice. It's a very good thing to do with your partner. You take turns, and you very often will actually be able to help each other create a big shift in some area of life just by being the witness for each other's confession and the witness for the experience of forgiveness that arises. And of course, please continue to write to the listserv. Share your experiences and your questions. It's tremendous joy being with all of you, and especially being part of this vortex that's created. And I know that those of you who are listening, who are downloading this, listening to it tomorrow or next week, that you also are inside this vortex, this powerful creation of community, of Sangham. And the effects of it will be felt in your practice and in your life. So thank you so much. I send you love and blessings from myself, from all those beings who surround us and wish us well. Have a beautiful week, a beautiful practice, a beautiful transformative life, as we walk our karmic path and turn it moment by moment into a beautiful destiny. With all my love, Namaste.